Welcome to another sermon podcast from Central Presbyterian Church in Atlanta, Georgia. This episode will feature a sermon delivered by the Reverend Shannon Johnson Kirshner. The sermon is based on scripture from Psalm 146, verses 8 through 21, and John chapter 19, verses 1 through 16a. It is the fifth of the series Jesus' Journey Through John and is titled Jesus and the Crowds. Central Sunday Morning Service for the 22nd of March, 2026, Fifth Sunday in Lent, was streamed to our website, our Facebook page, and our YouTube channel. A complete video or sermon audio replay of this service may be found on cpcatlanta.org. Select the upper right menu, and then Services under Worship.
Amen. We continue following Jesus in John's Gospel, and we're now to chapter 19, beginning with the first verse through the first part of verse 16. I invite you to again listen for God's living word. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. And the soldiers wove a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they dressed him in a purple robe. They kept coming up to him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews," and striking him on the face. Pilate went out again and said to Jesus' religious opponents, "Look, I'm bringing him out to you to let you know I find no case against him." Pilate said to the opponents, "Behold the man." When the religious leaders and the police saw him, they shouted, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him. I find no case against him." The leaders answered him, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he's claimed to be the Son of God." Now, when Pilate heard this, he was more afraid than ever. He entered his headquarters again and asked Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave no answer. Pilate therefore said to him, "Do you refuse to speak to me? Do you not know that I have power to release you and power to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no power over me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." From then on, Pilate tried to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar. Everyone who claims to be a king sets himself against Caesar." When Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus outside and sat on the judge's bench at a place called the Stone Pavement, or in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now, it was the day of preparation for the Passover. It was around noon. He said to the Jewish leaders, "Here's your king." They cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate asked them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The religious leaders answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Then Pilate handed Jesus over to them to be crucified. Holy wisdom, holy word. So a couple of times in the last few weeks, I've wondered why I thought it was a good idea to follow Jesus through the Gospel of John during this season of Lent. After all, the Gospel of John has its challenges. For one thing, it feels like we've been preaching Good Friday for the last couple of weeks, and we've not even gotten to Palm Sunday yet. But even more difficult for us is how this gospel writer speaks of the Jews. Now, if you've been following along in your own Bible, like Professor Johnson has been, you've undoubtedly noticed that I will often change the phrase "the Jews" to either the religious authorities or to Jesus' opponents. But since we will stay in this Gospel of John through Easter Sunday, and given the escalating war in the Middle East, we need to address up front what we now understand this gospel to mean when it talks about the Jews. Let's begin by declaring what it does not mean. This gospel is not saying that Jewish people are the enemy of Christian people. Jesus was Jewish. Furthermore, this gospel is not saying that all the Jewish people killed Jesus. There is not some universal stain against those who share Jesus' Jewish religious tradition. And we have to say those things out loud because, as we know, the Christian church has an awful and violent history of using this particular gospel as a rationale for anti-Semitism and for committing violent acts against Jewish people. In our history, Good Friday became a day on which Christian violence against Jewish people greatly increased. And so we must say no to such grievous, dangerous misinterpretations. For when we sink down into the Gospel of John and get a fuller understanding of the historical period in which it was written, we discover that the gospel writer was addressing his own Jewish Christian religious community, which had been expelled from the synagogue for reasons that are not entirely known. Yet in her excellent book, The Misunderstood Jew, The Church and the Scandal of the Jewish Jesus, Jewish New Testament scholar Amy Jill Levine claims there were a variety of good reasons that would have led to this expulsion. For example, she writes, considering this gospel was probably written down around 90 CE, it might have been that Jews feared being associated with Christians, even Jewish Christians, because they could be rounded up and persecuted alongside them. And that's just one possibility. Regardless of their reasons, though, the expulsion clearly angered the gospel writer a great deal, an anger we see expressed in his generalized language about the Jews. Frankly, sometimes John's language sounds like reactionary rhetoric, something we understand far too well in our own day and time. Clearly, the gospel writer had an agenda, an anger with those whom he felt had betrayed him and his community. And as we apply that historical perspective to our text today, we realize it means we can't simply make the trial of Jesus only about, quote, the Jews, as John would write. We cannot claim the cries of crucify him were only about them, the religious authorities, Jesus's Jewish opponents. No, the story of what happened to and with Jesus is not just about them. It's also about us. More particularly this Lent, I've been pondering if one way it's about us is because what happened to and with Jesus was a result of something we all know quite well, the overwhelming narrative of fear. A few minutes ago, I mentioned that one reason John and his community might have been expelled from the synagogue was because the Jewish people did not want to be associated with the early Christians and caught up in the web of persecution at the hands of Rome. They were afraid. But the fear of what could happen if they were associated with Jesus and his followers also emerged much earlier, and we also see this in John's gospel. Late Harvard Divinity professor Francois Bauvin pointed this out as he focused on the actions of the Jewish religious leaders in the Gospel of John. He reflected how in chapter 11, they basically said that if they kept letting Jesus go unchecked, then inevitably his preaching, his ability to gather crowds, and his proclamation that God's kingdom was arriving in him would strongly provoke Rome. And in response to that kind of provocation, the Romans would undoubtedly try to destroy the Jewish people's holy places, as well as their entire nation. In other words, Bauvin concluded, the Jewish religious leaders portrayed in this gospel had very good reasons for wishing to retain law and order and to avoid further disturbance instigated by Jesus. They were afraid for their people. Part of their task, then, was to do their very best to keep them out of Rome's crosshairs. And for that, that meant they had to get rid of the threat. They had to get rid of Jesus. Now, we also know that the religious authorities had other reasons for wanting to get rid of Jesus. As a Reform rabbi friend in Chicago told me, the rabbi Jesus challenged those religious leaders whose work had been corrupted, who tended to be more about self-preservation than about service. Furthermore, Jesus did proclaim what they considered to be blasphemous, that he was God's son, that God's reign was coming near in him. We cannot overlook Jesus' proclamation and provocative behavior while considering the religious leaders' motivations for pursuing Jesus to make a case against him. And yet, perhaps it is because the narrative of fear surrounds us so tightly this day that I don't think we can overlook the power of fear and the role fear played with the religious authorities, as well as with the crowd itself. Fear even held power over Jesus' disciples. Why else did they scatter? Why else did they hide behind a locked door? In the story of Jesus' trial and crucifixion, it seems that just about everyone, Pilate included, was afraid. Their own narratives of faith were taken over and displaced by the powerful narrative of fear. And what happens when one is dominated by fear? You do whatever it takes to feel safe. You get rid of the threat. In their case, you get rid of Jesus. Contemporary theologian Chris Bader Sayre puts it this way: just as we long for a diagnosis when we are sick, so we long for a way to name and locate our chaotic fears. Once we have a diagnosis, we know how to respond to our illness. We feel like we can do something. Likewise, once we locate the object or person for our fear, we feel empowered. We can now take tangible steps to make ourselves more safe. And when we decide the object or person's causing our fear, then insecurity, he continued, is no longer just the sad reality of a fallen and vulnerable world. It is rather the result of those people who pose a tangible and definable threat to us and our way of life. Indeed, he concluded, we exist as us precisely because we oppose what they are and what they do, end quote. We are hearing these kinds of statements today from our national security leadership in relation to the war with Iran. Get rid of the threat. Do whatever it takes to feel safer. Let the narrative of fear replace the narrative of faith. In his 2017 book, The Witness of Religion in an Age of Fear, Michael Kinneman suggests that for those of us who live in the United States of America, we are now in the midst of another period in which fear now dominates our national psyche, and another period in which the narrative of fear is replacing the narrative of faith, just as it did with those early disciples. Kinneman quotes a British sociologist who goes so far as to argue that a narrative of fear has actually become the primary framework through which Western societies interpret public experiences, leading to nations marked increasingly by security systems, gated communities, public surveillance, and a steady diet of media stories about dangers immediate or potential. This narrative of fear has become so internalized, as sociologist claims, that being frightened is no longer necessarily even linked to a specific threat. Being frightened is no longer even explicitly linked to a specific threat. The problem is not that we have fear, some of which may very well be warranted. The problem, rather, is that we now live in a state of perpetual fear that affects the way we see the world, creating anxiety in us that is not in proportion to actual danger. The problem, rather, is that we now live in a state of perpetual fear that affects the way we see the world and others, that creates anxiety in us that's not necessarily in proportion to actual danger. Doesn't that resonate? We see this unfold right before our eyes in this scene from John's Gospel. Remember from last week that the religious leaders who brought Jesus to Pilate were devout enough not to go into Pilate's house, lest they be considered unclean and unable to participate in the upcoming Passover. Clearly, their faith in God held great power in their lives. And yet somehow this state of fear over who Jesus was or over the kind of threat that Jesus posed in relationship to Rome started to crowd out their story of faith, at least in that moment. For those devout religious leaders moved from wanting to be faithful to their God of the covenant to uttering their own claims of blasphemy. "We have no king but the emperor," they proclaimed in their final attempt to influence Pilate towards crucifixion. "We have no king but the emperor." If they had not been so terribly afraid, they would have remembered that's not who they were. Their own Passover liturgy, which they were about to celebrate, claimed outright, "We have no king but Yahweh." Yet when these religious leaders allowed the narrative of fear to define them rather than their narrative of faith, they ended up renouncing their covenant with God and betraying what made them who they were. This heightened state of fear directly affected the way they saw the world. It replaced who they knew themselves to be as God's people. They wanted to do whatever they had to do to stay safe, get rid of the threat, get rid of Jesus, even if it meant getting rid of or at least denying what they believed to be true. "We have no king but the emperor," they devastatingly claimed. "So now, Pilate, you have to crucify him." But as I said earlier, this story is not about them. It's also about us. So how is the narrative of fear taking root in us in our own lives? If Kinnaman is right, then we're battling it all the time. So what kind of behaviors do we engage in? What kind of stereotypes do we feed, egged on by this perpetual state of fear that's becoming so entrenched in our spirits that it's affecting the way we see everything and everyone? How is this narrative of fear affecting our faith? Even if our lips say we believe, do our actions testify to the contrary? Do we find ourselves sometimes scattering or denying or doing whatever we can to get rid of whatever we feel is threatening us? Are we, like those religious leaders and like those in the crowd, so caught up sometimes in losing our own sense of power or our own way of life or our own sense of safety and control that we too forget who we are and what it means to be God's people? Would we have shouted "crucify" if we thought that might remove the threat and keep us safe? Do we agree with former President Richard Nixon, who once famously observed, "People react to fear, not love"? They don't teach that in Sunday school, but it's true. We're in the season of Lent, so let's be honest with ourselves. How much are we reacting out of fear these days, rather than out of love? Is the narrative of fear crowding out our narrative of faith on most days than not? Given all that's happening right now in our nation and our world, I would say it's got to be an active battle for the majority of us in worship this morning. I know it is for me. Fear about this war, fear about next year's midterms, fear about the way white Christian nationalism is on the rise in very dangerous ways. Fear about what we collectively are not teaching my young adult children about the power of compassion and kindness. The narrative of fear tries often to win over my narrative of faith. I want to do whatever it is to get rid of that threat. Do you deal with the same struggle? Does that resonate? Actual question, does that resonate with any of you? Thank you. There was, of course, one person in this story who wasn't afraid. And amazingly enough, he was the one who actually had something to be afraid of. Pain and suffering and death. Jesus was the only one in this entire scene from the Gospel of John who stands with courage, who remembers who he is and why he was there. He basically tells Pilate that Pilate has no power over him. He knows what's going to happen to him. And out of great love, he's determined to endure it so he might destroy it. We might even wonder if, as Jesus was handed over and the cries of "crucify" pierced the air, if he prayed that his courage might one day be remembered and give even his opponents courage. If he prayed that one day, "Be not afraid, fear not," would not only be heard as the angelic soundtrack for his birth, but as a perpetual soundtrack for our lives. For love and not fear was the only thing that Jesus was about. And love and not fear was the only narrative that claimed his life. So may it be so for you and for me and for this world that God so loves. But we're going to have to struggle with it together. Amen.
We are glad you joined us for this podcast from Central Presbyterian Church. Central is a welcoming congregation of the Presbyterian Church USA located in downtown Atlanta across from the state capitol. For more information about the life, work and ministries, please visit our website at cpcatlanta.org. We also invite you to join us for worship and Sunday school and experience this exciting and diverse body of believers who seek to be bearers of God's justice in the world. Thanks again for listening.